actually kill someone. Let's watch a sitcom or something.
No! They're calling it the airborne toxic event.
It won't come this way.
The leading American novelist, Don DeLillo, explores the idea that constant grave news coverage by the media may have replaced the novel as the tragic narrative of today.
News of disaster is the only narrative people need. The darker the news, the grander the narrative. News is the final addiction before what? I don't know. News is the final addiction.
Welcome to the Great American Novel Podcast. I'm Scott Yarbrough.
And I'm Kirk Kernut. And the book we're discussing today is Don DeLillo's White Noise. But Scott, before we get going today, I have an announcement.
Uh-oh. Okay.
From here on out, I would like to be known not as Kirk Kernut, but as K.R.K.Kernut. Because I just think that bolsters my standing in the academic community.
That's why you're wearing the sunglasses and the robes today.
That's exactly right. And I can finally come to grips with myself and say that I am the false character that follows that name around.
Although the problem with yours as opposed to J.A.K. Gladney is we'll probably be calling you Crick Kernut instead of Kirk Kernut.
Instead of Jack. Yeah. Yeah, I played with that joke for a while. So thanks for indulging me. But we are today talking about what for many people is the quintessential 1980s postmodernist novel. We'll talk about why that category fits, but also doesn't fit. This is a book that was released in January 1985. I had just turned 20 years old, and I remember exactly when this book came out. The date of publication was actually January 21st, 1985, and that day is notable for two very specific reasons. Scott, I don't know if you remember this at all, but January 1985 was a cold, cold month, and actually, that particular day, January 21st, is on record as being the coldest day of the century.
Ah.
Not of the decade, but of the century.
I believe that Florida State, where I was an undergraduate, canceled classes so no one had to go to school. And immediately, we gathered up a large group of friends from across campus and bundled up and then went out and played football all morning because it was too cold to go to class, but not too cold to get us out of having fun.
You know how you had key cards to get into your dorm? I remember the locks on the dorm freezing.
Right.
So they had to have people at the doors to let people in and out that day. January 21st also, by the way, happened to be the second inauguration of Ronald Reagan.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's historically an interesting coincidence, because if there is a single novel that somehow encapsulates the weirdness, the absurdity of the Reagan 80s, I would say it's probably White Noise.
Absolutely. It wins the National Book Award for the year. And when I think of books that I most associate with the 80s, the ones that come to mind the most for me, it's really probably three kinds of books. It's this book. It is the works of Toni Morrison, representing a giant sea change in the way the culture paid attention to works by African-American, particularly African-American women. And then the Brat Pack novels of Jay McInerney and Brady Snellis and Tama Janowitz and people like that. And they all came out, those Brat Packers, I remember, in those vintage international series where they all had the really stylish covers. And something about the style and the way the satirical take on culture came across a lot of those Brat Pack novels. And this book, although Don DeLillo was already a pretty well-established writer, this is the book I think one of the two or three he'll be most remembered for, but it's certainly not his first book. He had already been around. In fact, this is his eighth novel.
It's his eighth novel, and he is 15 years into a career at this point.
Right. So grew up in the Bronx, born in 1936 from an Italian-American family, graduated from Fordham. So, you know, one of the things that always has struck me as astounding, Kirk, is when you think of the cultural center of the universe, there are certain cities from a Western perspective that always come to mind. Paris is one, but New York is another.
Right.
It's one of the largest cities in the world, certainly in the Western world. It's had so many great museums, great universities, it has so many important people live there, so much going on. I'm always struck by the dearth, relatively speaking, of great writers who hail from New York. I'm sure this will make some people mad. If you look at the number of people who have always lived in New York since the time of the American Revolution to the current, it's the largest city in the country. I guess now it vies back and forth with Los Angeles. And compare it to how many people have lived in Mississippi and how many writers from Mississippi have been very big deals. How many cultural icons from Mississippi have been very big deals. It is astounding, but DeLillo, you know, top to bottom, serious New Yorker, burst on the scene with Americana, and I think maybe End Zone, which is his football book, really gets him noticed. Great Jones Street, a very weird rock and roll novel. And then finally, this one wins the National Book Award. He goes on after this to almost win it again with Libra, which is a really interesting fictional take on Lee Harvey Oswald. The very odd novel, Mal 2, which wins the Penn Faulkner Award and almost wins Pulitzer Prize. Underworld is one, I think, after a six-year break that, again, when people are thinking, what's the big book we're going to associate with DeLillo? It's probably, I would say, maybe not properly so, but White Noise, Libra, or Underworld, the ones he'll really stake his reputation on. Underworld's a kind of stylistic departure. It's not as complex in terms of the prose, and the characters are a little more relatable and identifiable than we see in early ones. Following up with books like The Body Artist, Cosmopolis, Falling Man, Zero K, The Silence is his most recent novel a few years ago. And I don't know, we've lost Cormac McCarthy, we've lost Toni Morrison, we've lost Philip Roth. Is DeLillo currently the biggest deal living writer?
Well, it's amazing. As I was remembering my experiences reading DeLillo, I stopped in my tracks to realize that the man is 87 years old.
Yeah.
I guess I always think of DeLillo as being about 55. He seemed ageless, both in his interests and his approach. I do think that he probably peaked in terms of the interest around him between White Noise and, say, Underworld.
Right.
That 12-year period, I would argue that of all of the living icons, he was considered the intellectual cream of the crop.
Yeah.
Even more so than Pynchon. Pynchon had been gone for 17 years and came back in the early 90s, but there was just an awareness there that his big book was Gravity's Rainbow. And I think Underworld ended a period for DeLillo where people expected that huge, massive, scopic great American novel from him. I remember very vividly in 1992 when the short story Pafko at the Wall first appeared in Harper's. That was something that if you were a grad student or in an English department, a lot of people just ran right out and bought. You talked about that story because it just seemed so audacious in terms of its style and strategy.
For those younger listeners, there was a time when magazines other than The New Yorker published writers,
right,
and when American writers were allowed to be published in magazines. So the gigantic swerve away from the print industry and the short fiction industry has always been very weird to me to observe. DeLillo was never known primarily as a short story writer, although he has a lot of very successful ones, and this one really was a part of Underworld. But you're right. It was a huge deal. And I think it's probably the other two people mentioned in the same breath as him would have been, on one hand, Pynchon. He's always more readable and more understandable than Pynchon, but there's definitely the people who are interested in a lot of his work and in Pynchon's work. There's a definite overlay in the Venn diagram of those writers. And in a different way, Philip Roth, as another New York, Northeastern area writer who's concerned with intellectual concerns as well as other things going on in the culture as well. It is weird to me how much his star has kind of fallen. You just don't hear people talking about DeLillo and whether it's a major deal, whether he gets a new book out. I don't know if that's because he just has released too many of them. I always pointed out to people when, I don't know, some musicians would keep churning out an album every year, though they clearly didn't have an album's worth of good material to release. If you look at people like Springsteen and Tom Petty,
yeah,
they didn't feel they had to have a new album out every single year. They'll wait and every few years come out for one when it's usually guaranteed to be at least pretty good.
I think the times have changed a little bit around DeLillo. I think that there is a perception of him out there that, not politically, but maybe in terms of the relationship between high and popular culture, that maybe he's a little too conservative in that regard. One of the things we'll talk about here is his relentless attitude toward people studying popular culture. What does white noise say about that?
Yeah.
You know, I remember very vividly reading reviews of Cosmopolis, where there is a reference to a rapper. And I think a lot of academics that are younger than us at this point, they have grown up studying popular culture, popular music, and they just do not entertain that divide anymore between the two. And I think part of DeLillo's theme and his works that are maybe less about history has to do with the place of the artist in American society.
Yeah.
And he generally tends to argue that they are falling in status to the entertainer. That's why we have so much of Elvis Presley in this book, alongside that other great icon of world history, Adolf Hitler. Very jarring juxtaposition. But in the period of the 80s, that was very much a contemporary attitude of humor. In fact, I was amused to be reminded, reading an article on this book, that only 3 years after this novel came out, there was actually a punk rocker who called himself Elvis Hitler for a few albums. I don't know if you remember him.
Don't, which is weird because I was very much into that kind of music at that point in time.
He had an album back then called From Memphis to Berlin, and that was the dumb joke back in the day. You know, it's very much a postmodern thing. It's sort of deflation. So there's a lot of these themes that we'll be talking about. I do have a question for you right off the bat, Scott.
Okay.
Let's start with the title and talk about what, in your mind, not so much in relation to the novel, but what does that title mean to you?
Well, if we talk about not in relation to the novel, I think of the meaningless noise of static from a television that we used to say tuned to a dead channel. People raised in a digital age probably have no understanding of that because you can't tune a television to a dead channel anymore and have it make noise, but it used to just be this background hiss and kind of staticky noise, or a radio station where the signals are canceling each other out and nothing comes through clearly. Again, that static background. As a metaphor in this novel, I take it to mean all the ways we try to interface with reality so that we're not confronted with reality. So we use pop culture to constantly keep us out of worrying about the things that are really important, and also consumerist culture, and also conspiracy theories and tabloidization of reality. It's weird to me the different ways some things seem so very prophetic in terms of where, like, the American Academy is going, then other things that are not really such a big deal now as they were in the 80s, or they've moved rather. And we can talk about that a little bit more as we go too. How about you? Do you have a thing about white noise? Or?
Well, that was kind of a loaded question because I have a very specific memory of maybe the first time I ever thought about what that phrase meant. And it was probably only a year before this novel came out. And I was in a dorm room, and there might have been some illegal substances involved, but some guy with a VCR showed me the movie Eraserhead by David Lynch.
Ah, absolutely.
And I'm sitting there watching this movie, maybe not firmly in my cups, but I remember saying to the guy, "What is wrong with your VCR? There's this hum that is going throughout the whole movie."
Constant hum, rhythmic hum in the background of that film.
In heaven, everything is fine. In heaven, everything is fine. In heaven, everything is fine.
he just looked at me like I was the biggest idiot on the face of the earth. And he was like, oh, man, you don't understand. David Lynch is using white noise to convey the industrial hum of existence. So that phrase was in my mind. It sort of opened my eyes up to this idea that there is all of this distracting. And I think your use of static is very important, because in the 80s, it was television, it was radio, it was the idea of a cloudy signal.
Well, there's a great story by DeLillo's predecessor, Pynchon, called Entropy. And it's probably his most famous story just because it's the one he gets anthologized all over the place. But it actually talks about things like signal to noise ratio and the idea of from a light wave transmission, which would be television waves and radio waves, we have a distinction between signal, where everything comes through clearly and we understand the communication, and all the other pieces, which are noise, which get between us and understanding what's going on. So I think that same central metaphor is carried through this novel. In some ways, I feel like, again, it's very prophetic. It's very much seeing a lot of ways that American culture is going to, I'm not going to say evolve so much as maybe devolve.
So I think there's a lot of things in this novel that when you first read it, you sit there and go, wow, these people have it easy. They only have one television.
Yeah.
There's talk of computers, but people aren't on laptops. People aren't on cell phones. But I also think it's very easy for us to transpose the circumstances out of this novel and project them into our own time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think one of the really interesting things to do with white noise, because we haven't touched upon the fact that this involves a disaster in the middle of the novel that turns out not to be much of a disaster.
Or does it?
Yeah, we don't know. But the whole idea of reading this novel during the pandemic, when there was absolute fear of contamination left and right, really gave it a whole new valence.
Right.
We refer to the fact that part two of this book is a long central chapter that concerns something called the airborne toxic event, which many years later, an actual rock band would take that name.
Right.
So that's one way in which this novel has a cultural imprint. But this is the idea, again, if you grew up in the mid-70s up through maybe the late 80s, I grew up in a town where they were building a nuclear reactor. And I remember it was also a chemical company town. And I have two very vivid memories of one having a chlorine spill. But then the other, there was some failure at the nuclear plant in the Three Mile Island era that people freaked out about.
Oh, wow.
But this whole notion of some sort of man-made disaster happening, and how does a catastrophe affect our lives? How do we process that? And do we look at it as, I hate to say exciting event, but an event that somehow gives our life purpose or shape.
Or drama.
Yeah, drama is an excellent way of thinking about it.
Do you remember the main thing people said over and over again who were in New York City on September 11th, 2001, what they kept saying to the media? It felt like I was in a movie. And that whole way that we some way or another try to mitigate experience, not through actually experiencing it, but through connecting it back to some other way that we've seen it in media or comprehended in media, well, astounded me. And it did, even back then, make me think of this novel and a lot of what it's saying.
Yeah.
Kirk, we've used this kind of statement a few times where we've called it postmodern. Do you think we ought to make a crack at trying to define postmodernism for our listeners?
Sure. Postmodernism is supposed to mark, long about 1960, a total break from modernism, which was considered a dead horse by that time.
Right.
And the basic idea of postmodernism is that everything is on the surface, that there is no deep meaning, there is no grand plan behind events, that everything is a contingency or random. But one of the founding ideas, too, is exactly what you were just talking about, is the idea that there is no living experience anymore in the second half of the 20th century that is not somehow mediated. We experience our lives either through television or through narratives that we are familiar with.
Right.
The classic example from this period is when Ronald Reagan gave up to give a speech where he told about a great war hero, and it turns out he was reciting the plot to a movie that he had seen. Just one of the ways in which we have no sense of what is actually firm reality and what is invented.
You know, when we think of modernism, if we're talking to a Scott Fitzgerald scholar such as yourself, we might spend a lot of time focusing on the dissolution of that lost generation and everything falling apart. They can't rely on the old standards. All the old certainties have died away. People are, their priorities in the wrong place. You think maybe of Babylon Revisited is a great story that really addresses all this. On the other hand, if you're talking to a Faulkner scholar, he's talking about experimentalism, stream of consciousness, the use of heavy reliance on things like a symbol, on very dense prose has to be unpacked. So that would be your James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, Faulkner mode, as opposed to the Hemingway, Fitzgerald, people like that mode. And so postmodernism is really taking that notion of the experimentalism, taking it further without the complete reliance all the time, too, on symbols, such as you say. And I think some of this comes out just with all these post-structural theorists like Roland Barthes, who's saying at a certain point when everything is determined by the structure that's so familiar, the formula that's so familiar, it's only the deviation or the swerve away from that that excites us. And then we have in Jacques Derrida coming in, who really sets the world on fire with his famous talk he gives at Johns Hopkins in the late 60s. And it's all about, you know, meaning is always indeterminate. It's always flexible. There's always some other way to look at it from a different perspective. And so it all goes back to those things you just said. Now, DeLillo is really not our originator of American postmodernism. We have before him Pynchon. We have John Barth, who's all about metafiction, and Robert Coover, who's doing, again, a lot of metafiction, other things. We have Kurt Vonnegut. All these guys predate him, but he does, with this novel, really become the poster boy for, I think maybe I would argue, successful postmodernism, because the problem with so many postmodernist works, and I kind of put a lot of Pynchon in this category, is it works very well as an intellectual experiment. It's not necessarily so successful as a work of art.
Part of the reason White Noise has endured for nearly 40 years is it's very accessible. And it does have one element that postmodernism revels in, satire. And people are kind of divided. I would say there are a lot of people who absolutely get turned off by the tone of this book, finding it smirky, looking down its nose at characters who are searching for meaning through things that they can't articulate or maybe not being able to find. But I also think there's an element in here where DeLillo's characters don't necessarily feel, I mean, they feel real. They feel identifiable. When I read Pynchon, they just seem cartoonish right down to the names.
Yeah, he doesn't mean for you to read it any other way.
Right. It's kind of a cartoon of modern life, where I think here he's got flesh and blood people. They're very flawed and maybe obtuse and not heroic in the way that we perhaps traditionalists want their characters to be, but they are recognizable. One of the ways to get going in this book is to look at it as both a campus satire, but also a satire of the suburbs, and asking, where do we find the meaning or the significance of life? Well, if we think that at one point, the meaning of life used to be in education and discovering history, the value of the past. Well, here it's all just a lump of information. There's no difference between Hitler and Elvis. We just spew out facts in a competition to see who can be top dog in a certain discipline.
Yeah.
And as far as the suburban attitude goes, it's the idea again of a certain middle class, white prosperity, where all the lives are fairly interchangeable, but there's a lurking sense of what we in graduate school always used to put in our papers called dis-ease, D-I-S-hyphen-E-A-S-E. Remember, we thought we were so smart using that play on words, not realizing it had been done to death when we were still in elementary school.
Nothing ever was new for us, it seems.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you think of this whole suburban satire in a way. We, instead of having the nuclear family, we have the post-nuclear family. And in one hand, you might say, well, that's the Brady Bunch. And they got there first in television, also with the suburban satire. But of course, the problem with the Brady Bunch is it sets you up with this very newfangled thing, the merged family from two parents, the father of three boys and the mother of three girls. But they still form a kind of seamless family unit. And although I've never made a study of the Brady Bunch and haven't seen it for many years, I don't remember there being a lot of problems with the merging of the two families other than the first year or first few episodes where I think they did a little bit of that. After that, they're just, this is your brother, this is your sister. You don't have any of the drama or angst. But here we have a family where Jack Gladney is married. Is it his third or fourth marriage to Babette?
So it's actually his fifth marriage. He's been married five times to four different women.
Five times.
So along in there, he's been married to the same woman twice. They have several children between them, none of which are theirs.
Denise is half Babette's, half former husband.
Right.
Heinrich is Jack's from a previous marriage. Steffi is Jack's from a previous marriage. And Wilder, the baby, that's Jack and Babette's, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that's still a blended family. I don't think they have any kids together, if I remember right.
And so they can't figure out a way to communicate. They can't figure out a way for them to get together. And so their big thing is to watch television, particularly documentaries of disaster, which have occurred. And they get so excited about death, about serial killers, about all kinds of things. And it's the only time they're all happy together as a family, that when they go shopping. And one of the things, Kirk, I find just fascinating all through all of this is how much weirder have we gotten in some of these areas? Because what didn't quite exist in the way we think of it now yet was reality television. And so our focus on watching people become dismantled in real time in the years since this has gotten to be worse and worse and crazier, where we want to see drama and conflict that isn't scripted, but quote unquote real. And of course, anyone with any brains knows that they're seeing something that's highly edited and shaped and pieced together in whatever way the producers want to.
Exactly.
So that feels very prescient to me as well.
We should note that CNN started in 1980.
Yeah.
But it really began to become popular about the time when they started doing 24-hour constant coverage of big issues, like, if you remember, Baby Jessica stuck in the well. And I brought this up because I remember vividly peak era DeLillo in 1991. I may have been taking a class in postmodernism when the Gulf War, the original Gulf War, broke out. And all people talked about was how entrancing the 24/7 CNN news coverage of the war was. You know, if you think that it's only a few years earlier that this novel is depicting people gathering around to rubberneck as a way of finding some excitement in their life, it absolutely does seem like he foresaw the future.
Well, and then we think of the academic satire. It seemed preposterous that you have an entire department that is internationally famous for just studying Hitler.
Right, right.
Not World War II, not history, not, I don't know, international affairs or world history or anything like that, but particularly Hitler. And it seemed even more ridiculous. You could have someone start a foundation in Elvis studies. But the truth is that the classical humanities of languages, literature, philosophy have kind of withered on the vine as undergraduates become more and more efficient and more about becoming employable and not realizing that if you're educated well, you can learn to do any vocation well. But if you're focused on only learning, being trained in a vocation, that's the only thing you've learned. And you've denied yourself all these other ways to learn more about the world. And graduate studies, on the other hand, have simply sprung into these thousands of different directions that are all kind of watered down social science. So one of the dangers of English studies is young new scholars in our area have a tendency to read one book of theory on something, kind of assume a certain level of expertise, and then write long papers about, well, we now understand about late capitalism in the early Victorian era, blah, 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 blah. Well, and then we look at sources, there's kind of one or two things, and there's a lot of very incautious assumptions that are not necessarily from my perspective, helping me understand the story or the book or the time in history better necessarily. And I think we have to choose, are we going to be good literary scholars or good or bad social scientists, or are we going to be good social scientists and the literature intrudes in a different way? And I think you can't have it both ways. You have to choose.
I think his use of Hitler is audacious, and it seems so much more today because of the elevation of fascism in our political discourse.
Yeah.
But it's important to remember that in the 80s, Hitler seemed, I hate to say this, but I think to most people, it seemed pretty ridiculous figure. I mean, it had been 50 years. Everybody assumed we were long past that. What he's really studying is the iconicity of Hitler.
Yeah, exactly.
And part of the joke is he is so far removed from the actual source of Hitler or whatever Hitler did that he doesn't even speak German.
Yeah.
And he feels a little inauthentic about that, but he's somehow managed to create this whole grift. It's almost like a scam subject.
Well, you think of like the Andy Warhol in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes, mm-hmm. which is a college student. I thought that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Who cares? What does that mean? Now we look at TikTok and Instagram, and I think, son of a bitch, he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Or the creation of the Sex Pistols as a scam that somehow became the snake eating its own tail. Although you have this legit real band over here, The Clash, you have the Ramones, you have all these other bands doing it. It's the Sex Pistols that drove everyone toward that music, although they were about as authentic as the Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it? The medium and the message are no longer different. The medium is a message at some point.
I think that's one way that the book gets short shrift. There are reviews out there even at the time or commentary more recently where they said, well, he wasn't really taking this sort of pop attitude anywhere. Even in 1984, it seemed sort of obvious to portray Hitler alongside Elvis on these terms. And Andy Warhol did it 20 years earlier. But again, I think you have to think about the fact that the Reagan era is a period where we are leading almost inexorably toward this false sense of capitalism triumphing. I mean, it's only four short years later before Francis Fukuyama comes out with a book called The End of History.
Right.
And the argument that democracy and capitalism have won.
Yeah.
And we know that's not true now, all of these years later.
And honestly, in here, the Hitler studies part is almost more just part of a general campus or academic satire, like you say. And it's really showing how image and popularity are more important than whether students are learning anything significant. So he wears his sunshades to teach the class. He doesn't go by his real name, which is Jack, J-A-C-K. But by a falsified initials, J.A.K. or
like J.R.R. Tolkien, you got to have that affectation.
Yeah, just the image. He wears his robes because he's a department chair, because it's a whole department of Hitler studies. And at this college on the hill, wherever he is, it's not necessarily supposed to be Cornell or anywhere like that, but it's similar to it.
Very significantly called the College on the Hill, which is, of course, a takeoff on the city on the hill. I do have to admit, Scott, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but, you know, I teach popular music, and there have been class sessions where I kept my Ray-Bans on just to dramatize the simulacrum of iconicity.
Oh, yeah. And it is about creating the image. But, you know, even while it's doing this, it is making fun of consumerism as well. There's a scene.
Yeah.
You probably remember this well. I know I do. In that the second big important zombies movie that was ever made from George Romero was Dawn of the Dead. And in Dawn of the Dead, the people trying to survive the zombie apocalypse or zombie outbreak, one small group of them, and there's all these satirical elements in Romero movies. It was a race statement. The first and the second was all about consumerism. They all flock to a mall thinking we can survive in a mall until this is suppressed because there's all this food and drink and also equipment for fighting zombies. And it becomes problematized because they don't get all the doors locked and all these zombies also flock to the mall. And one character says to the other, what are they all doing coming to the mall now that they're zombies? And the other character, and of course I'm paraphrasing, I haven't watched the movie in 20 years, but the other character says something like they're going to the places that are most important to them in life. And so the idea that people's whole lives are defined by them all, but of course we have a scene just like that in this novel where everything's defined by them going to the supermarket and they decide how important they are, how significant they are with this conspicuous consumerism of what you can afford to buy. What you do buy is what says who you are. And again, it's about image and our ability under late capitalism, quote unquote, to consume is what most defines us.
You can almost think of these sections as the 1980s response to the Great Gatsby, to where a lot of those possessions were things that upper class people were buying because they were newfangled.
Absolutely.
But now these are luxuries that the middle class, I mean, there's a whole hymn in the middle of this novel to the coffee maker,
yeah,
where he gets entranced. And you know he's just making fun of it, but at the same time, there is that sense of marvel. There's some ways in which this novel feels a little dated, but you just have to tell yourself when you come across these things, update it. So in the opening paragraph, we have this whole,
right,
almost like a funereal procession of station wagons delivering kids to the first day of school.
Right.
Well, of course, today we'd be taking them in minivans, right?
Minivans, exactly.
There's a level at which this novel makes you nostalgic for the station wagon or the mall. But I do remember in the 80s, when you were bored, that's what you did. You went to the mall. My friends and I used to have this whole riff about how you could do an entire sociology of mall culture, anthropology even, I guess, where you could break down all human types just by looking at the people around you. And of course, now malls are dead zones.
And now we have these giant outdoor, I don't know, outside malls, if you will, where these huge shopping plazas where you can move your car or you can walk, and it's almost like a little village with all these connected stores. And someone who gets extremely claustrophobic at Christmas time when it's hot in those places and they're overcrowded shopping malls, I'm kind of glad we went back to these so-called town centers and constructed realities. But again, it's all about the iconography and the image more than it is reality.
Let's talk about the supermarket a little bit, because I'm sort of fascinated by his portrayal of it. And we should mention there is a recent film adaptation of White Noise by Noah Baumbach, who just lost the Oscar recently for co-writing Barbie, very famous writer and director whose wife is in this movie, the director of Barbie.
Yep.
She plays Babette, Greta Gerwig. But the final scene of this movie is a dance number set in a supermarket that is just absolutely, pardon my French, batshit crazy. And what it is trying to do, I think in a way that feels very ham-fisted, is poke fun at the ecstasy that we supposedly get from all of the consumer choices at our hands when we go into the grocery store. If you see this scene, and it is on YouTube, they must have spent $1 million stalking this fake supermarket with all these elaborate cereal boxes and all of this kind of stuff. And it's supposed to be an almost ballet-like procession of people orgasmically enjoying their purchasing power. And the joke, of course, is that it's kind of an empty ritual.
One of the things that comes up in that is when he meets his new friend, Murray, who comes, and Murray has a tendency, and this is something that you really see in DeLillo, and I think is a hallmark of postmodern lit in general. He doesn't speak in dialogue, he speaks in speeches.
Right.
And so he comes in and he starts lecturing them on, oh, this is one of the ways we will have importance. This is one of the ways we'll understand the meaning of things. Throughout the 70s, all the kids raised on television were being constantly bombarded by commercials, go and buy, go and buy, go and buy. And in the 80s, you get the Reaganomics, you get Greed is Good in the Wall Street film, which shocked the director of that film because so many people started saying, that's right, greed is good, having totally missed the point of the movie, which is not particularly a good movie, I would say. Oliver Stone film with Charlie Sheen and Michael Douglas. Did have the effect, I guess, of resurrecting Douglas's career yet again. You know, that is always the danger of satire, right? But on the other hand, the closer reality gets to the satirical positing of things, the more it seems less satirical and a little more strange or chilling. When Jack is taking his son Heinrich somewhere in the car, the boy says, it's going to rain tonight.
Yeah.
And Jack says, "It's raining now," I said. "The radio said tonight," and he keeps driving him. "Look at the windshield. Is that rain or isn't it? I'm only telling you what they said. Just because it's on the radio doesn't mean we have to suspend belief in the evidence of our senses. Our senses are wrong a lot more than they're right. This has been proven in a laboratory. Don't you know all those theorems they say that say nothing is what it seems? There's no past, present, or future outside our own mind. So-called laws of motion are a big hoax. Even sound can trick the mind. Just because you don't hear sound doesn't mean it's not out there. Dogs can hear it, other animals. I'm sure there are sounds even dogs can't hear, but they exist in the air and waves. Maybe never stop. High, high, high pitch coming from somewhere. Is it raining or isn't it? I wouldn't want to have to say. What if someone held a gun to your head? Who, you? Someone, a man in a trench coat and smoky glasses. He holds a gun to your head and says, is it raining or not? All you have to do is tell the truth, and I'll put away my gun, take the next flight out of here. What truth does he want? Does he want the truth of someone traveling at almost the speed of light in another galaxy? Does he want the truth of someone in orbit around the neutron star? Maybe these people could see us through a telescope. It might look like we're 2 feet, 2 inches tall. It might be raining yesterday instead of today. And it just goes on, and Jack is just getting more and more irritated as Heinrich, he's just deconstructing everything Jack's saying. There is no real truth. There's no real determinacy. There's no way to understand objective reality. So we have that long growth from Nietzsche through Heidegger up through Derrida. And then, of course, in our last 10 years, it's fake news. One person's truth is another person's argument. All that coming back. And so just the way he talks about this, and to see it when I read it back then, is absurd. You would never have that kind of discussion in reality or in our classes or in colleges. And now, of course, it's like, oh my gosh, maybe it's a little more that way than we want it to be.
I think that's maybe one of the biggest hurdles for folks who are used to realistic dialogue, where characters are maybe hesitant to speak or mumbling, or quite honestly, if they're talking about relationships, right, and feelings and journeys of self-discovery. There's none of that in DeLillo. This is a novel of ideas, and the ideas are spelled out as much through people almost lecturing on ideas and making statements.
Yeah.
And I think that type of approach maybe pierces the membrane of fiction. It disallows our suspension of belief in a way that a lot of readers just get irritated by. But it's very difficult to have a novel of ideas if characters don't talk about ideas.
Right. That's a really good point. In fact, it's the only way you really can, I guess, have it mean something or have it be stated in all those different ways. One of the ways I think we would update it too is there's a big fascination with the tabloids and what the tabloids are saying throughout this. And a lot of people are getting their news and their reality from tabloids. And of course, we don't have tabloids anymore, but we do have, on the one hand, TikTok and all the websites. You know, I mean, people literally seem to believe, at least one guy did, that Hillary Clinton was running a sex slavery ring out of a basement under a pizza restaurant.
Wait a minute, she wasn't?
Not as far as anyone's been able to prove, unless there's some kind of interdimensional basement we didn't know, couldn't find.
I may have to double check you on that, Scott.
Well, just ring up QAnon and see what we can figure out. And one of the things we come back to quite often, as anyone who sits and watches the American scene, as the old P.T. Barnum idea, no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. And that seems to be true and borne out by streaming shows and influencers and all this other stuff. It is weird that our obsession with weirdness and crypto America, you know, Bigfoot and aliens and all that, though, is partly, like I said, some of that moved into Reddit and other forums on the internet. But the other half of it has become celebrity worship. And it's just more the iconography. I don't think there were just as many kind of super celebrities people were so obsessed with in the same way when this book comes out has become more common, which is to say, you still had your most gigantic music stars or gigantic, and your most gigantic movie stars or gigantic, but you didn't have people like the Kardashians, who never really had done anything when they became famous.
Well, the technologies are much harder to escape today. Like you said, this is a novel that takes place before the internet, and that just gives us a constant access to information, which is the source of the white noise. but also the illusion of intimacy,
right,
with whatever celebrities or pseudo celebrities are around. I mean, if Daniel Boorstein were alive today, the guy that coined the phrase pseudo celebrity and the phrase famous for being famous, he'd probably have a heart attack to see how that has proliferated. And I think there is an argument there that we, to coin a phrase from Neil Postman, who wrote a book about this in the early 90s, and then Roger Waters of Pink Floyd cobbed it for an album title, we're amusing ourselves to death.
Yeah.
Which happens to be a big theme in this novel itself.
Yep.
There's a lot of talk of death, a lot of fear of death. And I'm wondering, how does that play into this notion of the general unease of contemporary life?
Right. Well, we come back to the airborne toxic event, and there's some kind of airborne toxic event from a factory. This ominous cloud has moved over the area, and it's this mysterious substance that once it's in the ground, if you get it, you'll know only through strange flashes of paranoia and deja vu. Which means anytime you're struck with a little sense of deja vu or paranoia, you think, oh my gosh, I've gotten it. So it's the incredible snake eating its own tail situation again.
Right.
And it is a great way of talking about our obsession with death, or maybe even it being more about obsession with death. It's our incredible fear of death and how we're trying to, through all these other things, pretend like we're going to be immortal, or we avoid the reality that no one gets out of here alive.
Again, to sort of emphasize the difference between postmodernism and modernism, you know, modernism, there was the notion that death is inescapable, right? It's the fact of existence.
Right.
But that creates, and this is, I hate this word, it gets so misused all the time, but this is where the whole general concept of the existentialism came from, was that because there was a finite temporal limit to our existence, that every single moment was a kind of opportunity to test your ethical mettle. What do you believe in, and what are you doing in this moment? And are you really alive in a way that maybe measures out the daringness of being alive? And so that's why you get novels like The Stranger, where an act of murder supposedly brings the guy to an awareness of an existence or appreciation of it. We have a kind of takeoff on that at the end of this novel, but it's a failed one. Jack hunts down the guy who has been feeding his wife, Babette, these pills that are supposedly taking away of her fear of death. But what they're really doing, it's kind of proto-Prozac, to be quite honest. But what it's doing is making her forget. It's numbing her to the imminence of existence. But he fails. He realizes that shooting this guy does shoot him.
Right.
But he realizes that that's maybe a step too far, that that's maybe too real. And so there is a struggle here to find some sort of grip on what is real danger, what has real consequences, in a way that maybe people today who live their lives online don't appreciate as much. But I think in general, postmodernist sense was, the struggle against the postmodernist sense of death was, because death is going to happen, nothing matters, and what if it did? You got a lot of books in that period of time about how death is the ultimate narrative form. That's even said in this novel. All plots ultimately advance to death.
Right. We have Beckett as maybe the one paving the way from modernism into postmodernism with that obsession about death and the fact there's nothing you can do about it. And this is all futile to keep protesting it in a way. And maybe, though, the strength of this novel and some of his other work is that DeLillo himself is not comfortable with only presenting the problem. He also wants to, in the way that early modernists did, and I really like what you said, because it not only made me think of how it moves in existentialism of Camus, it also makes me think of For Whom the Bell Tolls, where there's so much stuff in that book that lets you know this is going to be a short and ultimately tragic fling that Robert Jordan is having with Maria. And yet the last pages of that book are really as profoundly moving about as anything you can read. And right when you think it's an A-Team episode, it's a bit more Shakespearean than that.
Well, it's an acceptance of the condition and the idea for Hemingway, who also, by the way, in Death of the Afternoon says all stories end in death, and he is no true storyteller who would not admit that.
Right.
It's that living up to your own ideal of courage.
Yeah, and DeLillo's contemporary, McCarthy, has been castigated sometimes for always writing about death and tragedy, and he says, well, it's the one thing that we all have in common and people do anything to avoid,
right,
is death. You don't kill your chicken anymore. You go buy it processed at Publix.
Yeah.
You don't have to kill your hog and slowly churn the meat into sausage. We just go buy it all pocket. Everything in the modern world has been about removing us from the reality of things. And what I think DeLillo is doing here in the book that's interesting is, even though over and over again Jack and Babette have failed at their previous marriages, he seems desperate to keep this one together and to keep it running. You would really think someone who's such a serial divorcer and remarrier that he'd hit the parachute at the first possible sign of trouble. And instead, he takes the gun. He goes after the guy who's been providing this drug to his wife. And, you know, I think this is during, I think you're right about the Prozac, because I think the 80s is when it starts being just overprescribed all over the place.
Ritalin, Prozac. I mean, it's about 9 years after this novel that we actually have memoirs like Elizabeth Wurtzel's Prozac Nation.
Yeah, exactly.
About young people our age at the time, you know, people in their 20s who in the 80s were being doped up on Prozac.
Yeah.
The fear of death sounds so grandiose and sounds so melodramatic in a way. But I think part of what the novel is straining for is when people have a certain comfort level of existence and they shouldn't have any reason to fear anything, the question becomes, where does happiness come from? And in a weird way, that's maybe the big concept that, to my memory, is not discussed in the novel.
Yeah.
Happiness, contentment, fulfillment. Is the fear of death just a neuroses that we develop because we have the time and it gives us a philosophical thing to grapple with?
Oh, that's a great question. I was going to say that I think what DeLillo seems to be offering here is that the answer really is human connections and human contact. Befriending people and holding on to your family and drawing them closer and not allowing them to be post-nuclear. Go back to the idea of what that term should mean, which is not necessarily a traditional family, but rather they're held together by some mysterious gravitational alchemical force, call it love, that makes their happiness more important than yours, and you sacrifice, and that gives kind of a sense of meaning. But like you say, it is pretty obscure in here. And I do think your question is the question that isn't openly asked in the novel, but is the significant one, which is, where do you find happiness? I think you're absolutely right.
I think DeLillo would find that question a little too sentimental, a little too emotional. And I think this is one of the reasons that maybe readers, when they get to the end of the novel, and I don't think we give anything away by telling what happens at the end, because this is a postmodern novel. It's not like something devastating is going to happen where there's going to be a big resolution. It's going to be as flat at the end as it is in the beginning.
Right.
I think there are readers out there who wish that the novel ended with what is the penultimate scene, which is their youngest child rides across the highway in order to view the sunset. And there's a beautiful moment where the entire city, the entire campus kind of gather and they look out on this sunset. And there's just a glimpse in there of people feeling a sense of awe.
Yeah.
The irony is the new glorious colors of the sunset are probably a little chemically tainted by this spill.
Yeah.
So we're not getting that great euphonic upsurge. But then he ends it, but we go back to the supermarket where all the shelves have been rearranged. And all of a sudden, people are confused. They can't find anything.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, that makes them engage more with the quest that they are on. All of a sudden, they're reading ingredients and they're hunting things down. They're seeing things for the first time. And the final lines of the book are very interesting because you come back to this notion of the tabloids. There's a sense of wandering now, not wondering, but wandering, an aimless and haunted mood, sweet-tempered people taken to the edge. They scrutinize the small print on packages, wary of a second level of betrayal. The men scan for stamp dates, the women for ingredients. Many have trouble making out the words, smeared print, ghost images. In the altered shelves, the ambient roar, in the plain and heartless fact of their decline, they try to work their way through confusion. But in the end, it doesn't matter what they think or see or feel. The terminals are equipped with holographic scanners which decode the binary secret of every item infallibly. This is the language of waves and radiation, or how the dead speak to the living. And this is where we wait together, regardless of age, our carts stocked with brightly colored goods, a slowly moving line, satisfying, giving us time to glance at the tabloids and the racks. Everything we need that is not food or love is here in the tabloid racks. The tales of the supernatural and the extraterrestrial, the miracle vitamins, the cures for cancer, the remedies for obesity, the cults of the famous and the dead. And many critics look at that last phrase in particular as an allusion to one of the great all-time modernist classics, James Joyce's The Dead, which ends with this beautiful image of snow gathering on graves as a sign of human transience, the passing of love, the passing of meaning, all of these. So I'm curious, what do you get out of that last paragraph, Scott?
Well, first, I absolutely have always heard in the cadence and the end word being the same, where Joyce writes about the snow is falling faintly and faintly falling, and it ends with all the living and the dead. And so there is that, just the cadence of it does evoke the dead for us. And in that story, of course, you have a young man who realizes he's not center of the universe. This woman has this other life that's gone on without him, and he's really act two or act three in her life. And the love of her life is dead, and he's kind of a follow-up possibility of diminished, less hope. And really, all through this, it seems to be saying that they have all that part you read, and you read it very well. There are all these ways they could look for meaning, but they're missing out on the main meaning, which is, what do we take from each other? What do we take from those who've come before? I don't know. Do you make more of it than that?
No, I think you're onto it. I think it's marvelously ambiguous.
Yeah.
There's a hint that there's more urgency, but there's a hint also that people are still zombified in this shopping center. This is one of the reasons that I think the whole movie ending totally punts it, where they dance through the supermarket. I mean, it's just supposed to be so joyous, but there's something that's, I think, absolutely grim about going to the grocery. We should mention that none of this stuff about the supermarket is necessarily new to the 1980s. I mean, one of the all-time famous classic American poems is Allen Ginsberg's A Supermarket in California, which in my mind is probably the earliest idea of this critique of,
right,
of American consumerism as a franchise palace where we can all go, where everything is available all at once.
Right. And you have that great short story from the early 60s by Updike, A&P, which has haunted many, many freshman literature classes, and juxtaposes the artificial false light of the supermarket and the linoleum floors and the lifelessness of the shelves versus the vibrancy of the beach and the outside. And
may appeal to men a little more than women, since it's portraying the girls in the bikinis that get booted out as the redemptive spark back to reality.
And the boy who wants to impress the girls and who quits to go after them, but he's a little too late to actually impress them.
Yep, story of our lives.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a case that DeLillo says, or I should say Jack Gladney says, there are paths through these meaningless fears and this obsessiveness we have. But as long as we're looking for the image, and as long as we're avoiding the realities by finding other ways to provide meaning in our life, it's going to be very hard to get there.
Yeah.
So I think, like you said, it is marvelously ambiguous, and there's just no way to really parse it more simply than that. So I think you said you don't teach it, so it's been a long time since you reread it. How did it hold up for you rereading it?
I think it's a wonderful read, going into it recognizing the genre that it's coming out from. I mean, if you can accept the fact that you're really grappling with ideas and theories and people looking for meaning rather than character development, if you can handle the absurdity.
Right.
I think a lot of readers find fault with the section where Jack hunts down Mr. Gray or Mink, who has been the drug dealer getting his wife hooked on this wonder drug.
Yeah.
I think for some readers, that sort of slips off to the improbability. We should mention that there's a lot in DeLillo about wonder drugs. Great Jones Street revolves around the idea of a kind of Weatherman-style revolutionary cult that's going to dump something called the product into America's water system. And what that's going to do is return everybody to a state of privacy outside of the media, because we won't be able to talk to each other.
And the other thing that shows up over and over again is people's obsessiveness over central characters. So you have a cult group who has kidnapped a poet, and they're trying to bring people in and Mal too. In this novel, the obsessions with Elvis and with Hitler. And so the idea that we're tending to worship these very strange earthly celebrities in ways that don't speak well of us shows up a lot.
I think Mao too is a wonderful renunciation of gurus and
yeah.
Those leaders. I mean, there's just a wonderful scene where they used to do the, you know, where Reverend Sun Young Moon used to do the mass weddings all at once. And there's a great take on that.
Right.
You know, if you want a break from domestic realism or novels about family relationships, if you're looking for a novel that really aims to capture the way that we live now and make a statement about it, I think it's a very compelling novel in that way. I understand 100% when people find it maybe a little too smirky or a little too condescending in its intellectualism, but those types of novels are very refreshing escapes
right.
from just the, I guess, the narrowing of what novels became about from about the 1950s on.
One of the things that's hurt the book a little bit is, and I always talk about this in film studies and there are many other works, is you can get away with a slow beginning or a really not engaging beginning, but you have to stick the ending. And this novel, like a whole lot of postmodern novels, like a lot of satires, although the last section is exquisitely written that you read part of, up until that part, the last quarter of the book kind of peters out, even with the violence being added and bringing in someone with the gun, as Chandler says, always makes it more interesting. Doesn't really kind of work. And there's an almost episodic quality. We have the setup of the family. We have the setup of the academic satire.
Yeah.
We have the airborne toxic event. Then we had the rise of the fear of death and this drug. That last part, it's almost like he had everything else going. And then he's just kind of working a way to bring it all together, and it maybe doesn't quite work completely, but I do think the novel, a lot of times you go back and you read a novel that has the kind of point of view, if this goes on, here's how bad things will be, and you kind of shrug and say, yeah, that doesn't really work anymore. And you go back and read this one, and it's really hits so many things on the nose that there's a certain joy in it for those reasons.
Again, we're so saturated by satire that I think people get turned off by it because it just feels a little obvious. And maybe sometimes his observations
right.
on what life in the 1980s was like may be a little too on the nose for people. And I certainly understand that. I think the rap on him would be that the later novels become a little too obtuse.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden, all your main characters are billionaires involved in efforts to change the universe, and you can't really relate to it on an individual level.
Yeah.
One thing I think the novel does avoid when it has all this talk about TV, I mean, it was very common for writers in the 80s to reference specific TV shows. You didn't have to be a postmodernist to do this. So you get people like Walker Percy doing plots that are built around an episode of Watching Donahue or something like that. So I think he manages, by focusing on the catastrophes in the news, he manages to avoid that. I mean, if I never have to read another novel that references the Brady Bunch, which you referenced earlier, I'd be overjoyed. I just think that kind of stuff becomes a go-to handy thing. And that becomes the rap on Pynchon, as he just
right.
glibly starts throwing out all of those nostalgic memories of TV at a certain time.
Right. Well, you think of what are the great satirical accomplishments? I mean, we've talked about Pynchon. We did an episode on Gravity's Rainbow. The other book that comes to mind, which is a bit more focused in terms of its satirical landscape, would be Catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vonnegut dips in and out with a lot of his more postmodern approaches, usually a bit more focused, really going after a certain thing. So Player Piano, Slaughterhouse-Five.
A lot of those novels tend to be built around major historical events like right. World War II. I'm thinking where, to me, this approach maybe becomes a dead end is in something like Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections, where
yeah.
you end up with just a bunch of characters that you don't like. You don't feel like the author likes them.
Yeah.
It's almost relentless in telling us how terrible contemporary life or how meaningless contemporary life is. And there is a lot of crap to culture, but you do want to have characters that are on some kind of quest for meaning.
There has to be something driving it other than people being irritable and irritated. You know, there has to be something else going on.
Right.
So is this a great American novel? Clearly it's American and about the American scene in the 80s. Do you feel it has sufficient heft, scope, and depth? I've got this 80s paperback and it's 325 pages or so. I think it's certainly long enough. Is about American themes. I think so. I think anytime we're getting into consumerism, we're getting into the academy, I think these are important things which have signifying weight in our culture. The real question comes down to, is it a significant artistic accomplishment? Does it demonstrate serious aesthetic value? And with that, will it prove durable? I mean, where do you stand on that?
I'm going to go ahead and say it is a great American novel because I do think it captures the feel of life at the time that it came out. I do think that if we are going to look for the ultimate Reagan-era novel, this is probably it. But it also doesn't seem necessarily trapped in time. I think many of the conditions that people struggle with are still with us.
Right.
I think if you're talking in terms of style, that's really where people would argue with you, because this notion of the flat, numb,
affectless character.
Yes. I think people are in a rebellion against that a little bit. That became quite the norm in the late 70s and 80s. People want a little more engagement with a voice. So maybe there would be the fault. I will say this, in terms of his list of works, I think this is the most influential for a reason.
Yeah.
Myself personally, I much prefer Great Jones Street, which got pretty bad reviews when it first came out. But I do think because it is maybe the most famous novel about rock and roll, has a place in people's understanding. I am going to try to teach Great Jones Street in the fall, and I'm trying to buffer myself that it's going to go over like a lead balloon. But I do think that novel says something about the nature of fame, and because it's done at the time or told from the perspective of a famous person rather than a consumer, it maybe means a little more. But the other one that I think is absolutely even better than Great Jones Street is Libra. I personally think Libra is his best book. You talk about a novel that takes a plot and gives it a feel of a thriller, but has all that intellectualism and makes its point about our seemingly inexhaustible love of conspiracy theories. To me, that is his crowning achievement.
I do agree completely. This is a great American novel, and I don't think it's without its flaws, but I think still it manages to marry the satirical stance well enough with commentary on the scene, well enough with maybe not everyone is developed far enough, but Jack Gladney in himself is such a captivating, interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately that makes it successful. And what you do get with Libra is it offers almost satirical commentary on our love of conspiracy theory and everything else, but you actually do get involved in the characters and get caught up in them. What's interesting is that comparison to Franzen. You know, I think Underworld was DeLillo participating in that way of writing as well. All these multiple characters being developed and giving you characters you could be engaged with. And it was very well received and is a pretty successful novel, but it kind of stands alone. It's the only one he wrote that has that doorstopper length and complexity of all these characters.
Has a historical sweep to it that gives it a grand ambition. You can feel it on every page. You know, one of the interesting things you could do with White Noise is use it as a way to both rehabilitate Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, but also reframe where the value of White Noise exists. You know, if you think of Babbitt as the early 20th century satire of the type of lives, let's face it, that most of us probably live. You know, very few of us go hunting for whales or embark on those grand quests.
Yeah.
So the meaning of life is, where do we find our epic adventure?
Right.
And those novels pair off quite nicely in asking that.
So we have an interesting choice for cannon fodder, and this would be probably DeLillo's successor as the most significant postmodern writer of the 90s, despite having ultimately a tragic death as we move into the 20th century. And this would be Kirk.
This would be David Foster Wallace's first novel, The Broom of the System, published in 1987 when he was all of 25, 26 at the time. Very audacious debut novel, but also fairly obviously influenced by Pynchon and DeLillo. And I think it's an interesting book. It doesn't get taught as much in the same breath as his essays or his magnum opus, Infinite Jest, which is the self-conscious effort at topping Ulysses. But The Broom of the System reminds me a lot of White Noise in the sense that it has
a
main protagonist that's caught up in familial dramas, but also has other subplots. And it is a novel that is weighing the effort to find deep meaning against the absurdity of contemporary life. So if you have not read that novel in a while, or if you've never read it, and quite honestly, if you're a little scared of David Foster Wallace, I would suggest that that might be the place to start.
That's a great idea. And I tend to think Infinite Jest is worth reading, but pretty horribly overblown in its importance in some ways. But I think his short stories are way better. People give him credit for. And I kind of agree that his essays are where really he does his best work. But I do think Broom of the System is a great place to see what Wallace is. And again, he commits suicide in
2008, I believe.
Yeah, 2008. So he makes it a decade into the 21st century, but that's all he does. And again, into one of these writers who makes a pretty big impact for not being with us that long. Kirk, our next book we've chosen is Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger.
This is going to be a great one. You talk about a novel with a deep cultural imprint. Lots of controversies around it. I think one of the questions we'll ask is, at the age of 72 or 3 years old, does that book still speak to the idealism of adolescence and the way that it was famous for? A lot of book with associated tragedy, too. I think, unfortunately, it became the Bible of deranged, maladjusted people in the 80s. So we'll talk about all of that. There's an argument to be made that Holden Caulfield is the incel, if you want to argue it that way. I would not go that far, but I have seen that spoken. A lot of revision going on about Salinger. We will talk about both the pros and certainly a lot of the cons of glorifying youth.
Absolutely. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to the Great American Novel Podcast. Please follow us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. And if you're so inclined, we'd appreciate it if you're willing to leave favorable reviews. With regret, we remind you the views of the host do not reflect the views of their home institutions or any relatives or affiliations to their great loss. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may enjoy others, such as Master the 40 of Kirk and Robert Trogdon, focusing on a short story to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Reading McCarthy with myself and various guests about the works of Cormac McCarthy.
You can always email us at greatamericannovelpodcast@gmail.com. As always, we thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.